I'm a big believer that every business should be treated like a saleable asset. And if you build your business right, at the end of the day, when you want to walk away, you should be able to have something to sell and fund your retirement.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your company's spend without buying an ERP, but we're not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Peter Pillock from Pathway. He's a fractional CFO who has a pro background as a programmer. So we're going to talk about the transition from programming to finances, his experience running ERPs and building out ERPs, and how that has impacted how he advises his clients today. We're also going to talk about manufacturing, tariffs, how that's impacting everything. I'm going to round it out with a discussion about how he's built his business with his wife, something that I did many years ago. And maybe we'll have a little chat to see whether that's been a good idea or not. So, Peter, you're very welcome to the show. Maybe you could tell us something about you that not many people know to kick us off.
I'm delighted to be here. Things that most people don't know. I have a black belt in judo and a black belt in combat judo from a little bit of an earlier time. So, and actually my instructor was British. So,
well, you know what? Me too. I'm a showdown.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, very good.
Yeah. Yep.
My instructor was taught by one of the original 12 students of Jigoro Kano.
Oh my God, that's insane. Now,
so
we've lost everyone else here. No one else knows what we're talking about. But that is, Jigoro Kano is like the god of judo. He's the guy who created it back in the 1930s or 20s, right?
Yeah.
Insane. Well, I was also a fighting black belt, and I got my, this is, I only say it to you because no one else will understand. I got my black belt by Batsugan back when I was 17, and it was probably the proudest moment of my life. You know, it was like Batsugan is hard to get, and it really sort of, the scene, it gave me such confidence in the rest of my life. So, well, if I could do that, I can do anything.
Exactly.
Where did you go? You said you were competing. So what level, what's your favorite judo moment from your memory and what did it teach you?
Oh, good question. My favorite moment was the first match that I won in a tournament. I think I was around 17 as well. The guy turned his back to me in a tournament, and that's something you can never do. And it was my first victory by choke.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. That was a good lesson also on other levels that you should never turn your back when the chips matter. So,
okay. Well, all right. Well, I would very happily talk to you for 40 minutes about judo, but we're not here for that today. So maybe another time we can do that. It's a great sport. And, you know, people hear choking, they think that's weird, but actually the best thing about it is it's totally safe. I know that doesn't sound, it's counterintuitive, but like it's the great thing about it is you can do it fully with no fear of hurting anyone, basically. It's only the beginners that hurt anyone, right? It's all the people who know what they're doing, you never get hurt with. So
that's right.
Yeah. Maybe there's a lesson there. Maybe it's the beginner, the amateurs in professional world. You need to stick with the professionals. Yeah. Okay.
True.
So it's a good start here. I like this. So now I want to touch on your background because you and me have a lot in common. You were both black belts in judo. We both were programmers. We started off. But let me just tell me how did you get from programming to finance? What was the path you took?
So I have a very eclectic background, and I went to a training school, would be a better way of putting it, to be a programmer. So I learned how to program, and in school I met my partner at the time and one of the instructors. And so we decided we were going to form a computer programming company. This was probably when I was 25, so quite a while ago. So we formed a computer programming company, custom programming, probably about 93. So we're quite a while ago. And we just slowly grew the business. And due to the nature of industry in my area, the manufacturing was mostly automotive. So we ended up working with some clients in the automotive industry.
And so, you know, I'm kind of we brand ourselves kind of against ERPs in a way, like, you know, 75% of your implementations don't reach their business outcomes, you know, that they were stated. And, you know, there's a lot of people like to rag on ERPs. What's your take from that time working on this software that you take forward to your business today?
So when we were implementing what is now known as an ERP, there really wasn't much on the market. So we were ahead of our time. Calling our software an ERP today would probably be maybe not be as full of an implementation as some of the bigger ERPs. But one of the things that I learned is sometimes the software can get in the way of what you're trying to accomplish. So just because you need to track something doesn't mean, or just because you can track something doesn't mean you should track something. And ERP software in particular kind of gets in the way and in many cases wants you to track everything. You get information overload. So when we developed our software early on, we were pretty focused on what we wanted to measure, track, and manage.
Yeah, I've fallen into this trap sometimes. Is you get it's when you because you can track things, you end up tracking everything, and you end up with a wall of data. And you're like, you have to ask yourself the question: so what? What are you going to do differently? Like, unless the data is going to cause you to do something differently, then what's the point in it? But it's far harder to do that intellectual exercise about, well, what do I want to? What am I going to do? What am I trying to improve? And then work backwards from there. It's much easier just to go, oh, let's start tracking, you know, or outstanding order time, and let's start, you know, doing approval times and all these things when, you know, you have to say, well, what are you going to do with it at the end of the day? So and then you retrained in finance. Did you get a CPA or what sort of
take? I'm not a CPA. My educational background has always included finance. And so when we were dealing with ERP, when we were creating the ERP, I did lean heavily on my finance education, looking so looking to what was important to track, what needed to be tracked, what didn't need to be tracked and managed. And of course, clients always tell you what they think they want, and then you go from there. So I always had a background with finance, not CPA specifically, but
okay. So is this working in industry on a finance team? And yeah, okay, right. The operations of it. Okay, so I'm trying to get this clear in my head, really. So when you're working on in a finance team, is that mainly sort of a controller role? You're not really doing the books per se, but is that like AP, AR, accounts receivable, accounts payable, like dealing with suppliers? What was the day-to-day of what you were doing mostly?
So there was some... There's always going to be some form of bookkeeping.
Right.
When I started to transition out of software, I basically started giving more advice on to the clients about manufacturing. And eventually that led, I had one hybrid role where I was doing IT work and providing some financial consulting. That was a cookie manufacturing company. Cool. And that was actually an interesting role as well. And then from there, that was sort of where I got bit by finance is more interesting. It's more than just numbers bug. And after that role, I worked for a financial services company doing IT, taking care of all sorts of things, and then transitioned basically to bookkeeping, accounting, controller and CFO services. So that was sort of my path.
Very good. So you, before the show, we were talking a little bit about one of your favorite clients. I'm going to call them one of your favorite clients. You can't possibly say that, but you have a good story about it was initially a Canadian company that started off importing parts from Germany, and you were trying to help them on their profitability. So where were they by the time you got to them? And tell us the story about how you helped them develop their business using your finance skills.
So this particular client he's in an extremely niche market, providing services originally for a very niche clientele. He's one of the only people in Canada. I think he may actually be the only person in Canada working on particular series of machines. And in North America, one of a handful. So he was importing parts from Germany for these particular machines that he works on. And what he ended up realizing is by the time is two things. One, ordering parts from Europe, the lead time is can be pretty long. So what he decided he would do is start sourcing parts locally whenever possible. So he found some local distributors of parts. And for other parts that needed some tweaking, he had local manufacturers build the parts, eliminating months of lead time and, in some cases, markup.
So I can
So.
see how that can work. So the can you give us a bit of color about the type of business? It's a niche business. What sort of machine was it? And was it were they complicated parts or were they, I don't know, die cut metal parts or I don't know. I don't really know what I'm talking about now, but like tell us a bit more about what the product was and what the part was.
So he works on woodworking machines, and as you can imagine, in Canada we have a lot of wood, so it's in the woodworking niche or market. So there's a lot of so a lot of the parts can be bought off the shelf with other manufacturers, and once your warranty for the machines has expired, you're not held hostage to the same level for OEM parts. You can start looking elsewhere. So he started looking elsewhere.
And from a finance perspective, like wear and tear on machines like that, is that a big deal you have to be aware of? How do you handle sort of the wear and tear you're going to have on, and does it impact the business materially?
So wear and tear on mechanical parts, regardless of the industry or machine, is a potential problem. A lot of and having a machine go down for my clients, it could cost them days of production, weeks in some cases. So the cost for the to the client is potentially high. So my client, realizing that if he could source his parts locally or as locally as possible, he can cut the lead time. He can cut his inventory because he doesn't have to buy, 50 parts. He can get 10 manufactured. He was able to cut his lead time, his storage, and provide, and frankly, the cost was cheaper. So he's able to pass that on to his clients.
Okay, so I'm beginning to see the opportunity here. Like the part itself may or may not be very expensive, but if you have labor standing around waiting for 3 days or a week or 2 weeks for the item to arrive, that suddenly gets pricey really quickly. In fact, we released a report about the junior mining industry in February 2025, and we talked about this very issue about getting the right parts on site at the right time is really important. And then managing these projects, to take that into account is that's the problem. Like it one breaks down unexpectedly and then, it blows your project plan at the door. So do people mitigate for that by just having lots of spare parts around the place? I mean, this is what your customers seem to do start off with, but why doesn't everyone just buy 10 rather than wait until you need one?
That's a good question. So most of his clients were small. So having money sunk in spare parts for his clients got costly. So one of the things that I learned when I was working in the automotive area with developing my ERP is the just-in-time manufacturing. And one of the benefits of just-in-time manufacturing is you don't have to keep an inventory because, in theory, if everybody else is following a similar manufacturing strategy, you should be able to get parts quickly and not worry about downtime. And most just-in-time manufacturing, many parts are made within hundreds of miles of the plant that needs them. So that's effectively what my client did without knowing what he was doing. He was creating a just-in-time manufacturing system for the parts for his clients. So when we discussed about it, it made sense to him that there was an actual technique that he was using without realizing that's what he was doing.
Okay, so yeah, so you're building up too much inventory. That's your profit sitting on the shelf, basically, right? Your working capital requirements go up, and then, that's all money you could be spending on a nice new car if you didn't have to manage to maintain it. So it's a balance there and trying to figure out where it comes. So, okay, so as I understand it, then, there was a they stubbed their toe. There was a supply chain issue with this part. it was in COVID. And then he started to figure out, well, maybe I can manufacture this myself. And then where did you go from there? Did you start to distribute to other buyers for this part in Canada? And where's the business at now?
So everything sort of happened around COVID. I think that's ground zero for a lot of changes for, frankly, most people. So that made COVID made shipping and getting parts from Europe far more difficult because in Canada, stuff was stuck in our ports. So parts that should have taken a month were taking 2 months to get offloaded, made through customs, etc. So that's when my client started looking and seeing if he could start manufacturing closer to home. And it started with parts that he could buy from different manufacturers off the shelf, screws and bearings. And then it expanded to some other parts that required a little bit more effort on his part. So yeah, COVID was big for the changes for my client.
How much did it change his business? What sort of proportion of his business now is manufacturing versus it was just actual, you know, production, I guess?
He likes servicing machines. So he's probably going to service machines until he cannot service machines anymore.
Right.
It's really hard to say. The parts is probably, as he gets closer to retirement, it's probably going to be 100% of his business. But right now, it's probably 20%. He's still doing some, he's still building that side.
Okay. And then there's going to be more enterprise value for him. So this is a business that basically, it's probably worth one times revenue, maybe it's typical service business. And now he's getting closer to retirement. He's got this other proportion, which actually has some value of its own. And he might be able to help him fund his retirement by the sounds of it, you know, if he can get it up to the right level.
That's exactly the plan. That is exactly our plan. I'm a big believer that every business should be treated like a saleable asset. So and if you build your business right, at the end of the day, when you want to walk away, you should be able to have something to sell and fund your retirement. And if you're really lucky, you can do that well before you hit retirement age, but not everyone gets that opportunity. So,
yeah, this is one of the things I think people should start there with their CFO. I mean, it might sound like a sort of non-professional thing to do, say start, and we all need to retire. That's 100% certain, right? You either drop dead or you get to retirement at some stage. So, you know, this is a great thing that your CFO is integral to making that plan happen, right? So it doesn't just happen by accident. You'll just end up working for other people one way or another until you drop. So you got to be conscious about it. And it's interesting to see that you take that view with your clients and sort of have that conversation, basically, you know, because that's realistic. No matter how fancy you think you are, everyone needs to retire. At a base case, you need some retirement. Maybe you could already, it's like you say, but most of us can't. And why not just have that plan written somewhere, you know, so you can get it. And your CFO is the person who can make it happen for you. And I guess that's got to be motivating for you as well. Then, you know, you're just not running your numbers. You're making a difference to this guy's life, you know?
Yeah. And the side effect of having that mindset is, it ensures you're building an organized and focused business, because if the end goal is to sell something, there are criteria that purchasers are going to be looking for. So, but those criteria make for a good business. So you're doing the right thing more often than not by planning for the sale. So it's sort of a double bonus.
Yeah, well, it makes it a nicer business a lot of times. Like something that someone else would want to buy is, ergo, a nicer business to run, because, you know, like that's why they want to buy it. Now, just before we leave this topic, maybe we could just touch, we're recording here February 2025, touch on tariffs. It's, you know, it's all getting real, especially if you're based in Canada like you are, I guess. What's your thoughts on there? Has that impacted this business or other clients?
We're bearing the brunt of a lot of the conversations coming from the United States on tariffs. And frankly, most of the information coming out is erroneous at best. In my clients, the reaction has been, okay, we'll just find new markets. My client's manufacturing business that we've been discussing, his profit margin in the parts that he's selling is extremely high. So when he's been working with U.S. distributors, tariffs or not, it's still a good fit. But as a nation, Canadians are preparing for looking to alternative markets, in particular Europe and China. Frankly, we've been lazy as a nation. We have one of the largest markets in the world, so you tend to want to trade with the largest market if it's easy. Well, now it's no longer easy, so we have to start thinking and making changes.
Well, that reminds me a little bit of the Brexit discussion, right? The Brits were like, hey, we can just deal with the rest of the world. But the reality is it's a giant market that almost no one can ignore. You know, sure, diversify. Yeah. I guess that's the lesson. Diversify your customer base. But, you know, at the end of the day, no one can afford to ignore the U.S. So, right.
And I certainly don't fault a nation wanting to look out for itself. But I don't think that's necessarily the issue, I think. But I'm not holding any blame for someone thinking about themselves in the way that they are. Whether I agree with what they're doing or whether I think it's the right thing for the States is irrelevant. But I understand why they're doing what they're doing. I just happen to think it's short-sighted and perhaps foolish. But that's my opinion. We've all got opinions, so.
Well, by the time this podcast comes out, maybe we'll know more. So future listeners, you can tell us what we were, how worried we were. But were we right? Were we not? Let's find out. So, I'd like to switch over to your own practice and how you built it. I know you mentioned that you work with your wife. How did that come about and how's that going? Because I have some experience with that and it worked well until it didn't. So how do you split the responsibilities?
So we have a sort of a very clear distinction in what we do. My cat's joined us. My wife handles the taxes and I handle everything else. So we do, especially this time of year, we do quite a bit of tax work. So it's a line that's really good for us because having that distinct wall allows us to have discussions about clients. It's much similar to, say, some of the larger firms. I can come up with a tax strategy for a client and she can tell me whether it's valid or not, or whether I'm crazy or whether she thinks it's brilliant, which doesn't happen as often as I wish. But and we've had some interesting discussions. So our rule has been whoever files the taxes and has to deal with the Canadian Revenue Agency gets the final say on tax strategies, which tends to be her. But then when they call, she has to deal with the phone call. So, but frankly, we work well together. We always have. And I think our clients love the dynamic when we have meetings with both of us. The clients love seeing us discuss their issues in real time. So,
yeah. All right. Very good. All right. Well, you're getting a genuine connection, I guess. I do think people work with fractional CFOs is much more a personality fit than it is a technical fit. That's a nice insight into how your firm is run. So tell us, who is your ideal customer? Like, who do you really enjoy working with the most?
So we have a fairly eclectic client base. I do like to work with people who are curious and creative, who like to look at a problem and come up with interesting solutions. And I really like to help those people achieve their goals and thoughts. So someone like my client we mentioned who saw a gap in the market, wasn't originally sure how he was going to get by the issue with the shipping from Europe, and then came up with a solution and worked with us to get that solved and to achieve his goal. Those are the clients we really love working with. We can make an impact. So I always joke with my wife, a lot of accountants like to say no. I like to say how. So when a client comes to me and they, in many cases, have said, my last accountant said, we can't do this for reason A, B, and C. I would like to say, A, B, and C, you might be correct, but for reason D is why we can do it. So let's start approaching the problem with D mindset, if you will. So we solve a problem that other people don't think can be solved.
Cool. That fits very well with true entrepreneurs, if you like, people who are always looking for, some people call it an angle, some people call it a creativity. Some people call it fraud, but depending on how far you go. But like, true. I guess that's the whole point. Like, you don't know until you try, right?
If anyone from the government is listening, I never encourage my clients to commit tax fraud.
Well, asking for a friend, I mean, I have this friend who I will remain anonymous, but like, is constantly coming up like, what if we put the revenue here and then we put it over here and we keep it on this account and we do this thing? You know, it's like, no, just calm down. Let's just try and make our business work well. Don't worry about shifting all the money around and using offshore and doing all this stuff. No, just, okay. All right. Okay. Well, I guess I should ask, how can people get in touch with you, Peter?
So the best way is find me on LinkedIn. And that is my last name is Pilluk, P-I-L-U-K. Peter, and I believe I'm the only one on LinkedIn, so I should be easy enough to find.
Very good. That's a useful strategy. Annoyingly, there's a James Kennedy out there who's like a teenage heartthrob sort of musician or something. I don't know what he is, but he's taken all my social names from me. But anyway. Okay. And then the last question I'm going to ask you is, who is your business hero and why?
So that is a good question. I tend not to have heroes. But if I had to pick someone, it would probably be Mark Cuban, especially with what he's doing with his drug company in the States. I have a lot of respect for people that could ride off into the sunset and live their life, but instead choose to make a difference. And in the States, the drug companies wield an awful lot of power. And for him to say, no more, no longer will you have this power, and make low-cost drugs available to Americans is, in my opinion, should be the goal of every successful person, to make life better for those that didn't have the same opportunities or had to work harder because of their circumstances. So I respect any business person that has that mindset.
Yeah. Cost plus drugs, I believe, is his business. Yeah. Or the one he's running with a surgeon or a doctor, I think. And and it strikes me sometimes there's a lot of, at the moment in the news, there's a lot of talk about, you know, the billionaires is a derogatory term for what they're doing, especially in the government in the US. But it always thinks of, well, you know, they don't have to be doing any of that. You know, like they could be, like you're saying, they could be on a yacht somewhere and instead they're, you know, doing what they think is useful for everyone, you know? So God bless them, you know, like they might be right. I might be right, but they're pretty competent people who are still in the game when they don't need to be, you know, I'm sure I'd be the same, to be honest. Here we go. All right, Peter. All right, Peter, thanks very much for listening. And if you are still listening, thank you very much for getting this far into the show. As your special reward, you were able to go to procurementexpress.com/CFO mastermind. We're running monthly masterminds for fractional CFOs. It's an opportunity for you to bring along a business challenge that you have. We bring you in a breakout room on Zoom. We'll put you in a group with three or four other peers, fractional CFOs from around the world, and you get to brainstorm that business problem with the others and get some feedback. So it's very popular. It's a lot of fun. It's good. And I invite you to sign up for that if you got this far. And thanks very much for listening. Thanks, Peter. This was a good one.
Thank you. It was an interesting conversation.